anything. Gwen and I are alike in that. We followed the game trail about 30 minutes when I pick up the smell of something dead. It's strong and sweet sour in the back of my throat. Connor gets it too and covers his nose. "What's that?" he asks. "Is it a skunk?" "Hope so," I say, but it isn't. The wind shifts and the smell's gone. I check the direction the leaves are bending. The breeze has quartered, so I make a turn off the path to find the smell again. It hits me like a pan in the face, hot, greasy, sickening. Not a skunk, alive or dead. This is something bigger. We're off the path. I stop. "Connor, check the map," I tell him. He obediently pulls it out of his pack. "Mark where we are right now." He does, and I check it. We're close to Wolf Hunter River, which is an offshoot of larger waterways. These days it's more of an oversized creek, but it's likely dangerous in flood stages. We passed it over on the way to the lodge. The sky is blue and empty of clouds, but flash flooding can happen miles upstream, and it's nothing to mess around with.
"Are we going to find it?"
he says. "The dead thing? Do you want to find it?" He has to think it over, but then he nods.
"Yeah.
You know what we find might be terrible, right?"
"I know,"
he says, and I'm sure he does. He's old enough to Google and turn off the parental controls without Gwen noticing. He looks up at me.
"It's the right thing to do, though. I mean, it might be an animal, but what if it isn't? There are people missing."
Gwen's going to hate me for it, but I'm not about to treat this brave kid like he's made out of glass.
"Okay,"
I tell him. "Mark the trail on the map as we go." I take the marker out and swipe it along the trunks of trees as we go. They're heavy here, but the underbrush is fairly light, and we're able to push through. We startle birds that take off in a rush of wings and cries, but it's almost lost in the thrashing hiss of the trees. It's getting darker in the cover, and for safety I stop Connor and get him to take out his flashlight while I retrieve mine. The halogen beams slice the gloom like scalpels. I widen the output on mine. It doesn't go as far, but I like to see what's coming on the sides. It's still and silent, except for the sound of the trees and now distant bird calls. No traffic sounds, no planes overhead. The farther in we get, the more isolated we are, and I start worrying about wildlife. Dead bodies attract scavengers, particularly bears. But we don't have to go far, and we don't see a bear. Just a small, dappled bobcat that slinks silently away the instant I spot him. The smell continues to increase in intensity, but I don't initially see the body, or at least recognize it for what it is. It's by the bank of the Wolf Hunter River, and the green water laps at the edges of the thing lying there. I think for a second. It's a deer, because it's unnaturally shaped and splayed, and dark even in the glow of our combined light beams. But a deer doesn't wear sandals, or have braces on exposed white teeth. "Get back," I tell Connor, and I step in front of him. 10 feet back, right now."
"That's..."
He sounds shaken.
That's not a body, is it?"
"Connor, do as I say. Walk back 10 feet. Don't look." I cover my nose and mouth with the bend of my arm and walk a little closer. She's not dressed except for the shoes. He made her walk here, I think. Maybe she begged to keep her shoes on, and he allowed that small mercy. I don't see any sign of other clothes scattered nearby. I can't tell how she died, what she might have looked like, or even what race she might be. The body's so bloated and distorted, it looks like a Hollywood monster prop. She had. Blonde hair, though. Tufts of it have been pulled out and are caught on bushes nearby, and strands wave gently in the river water. Animals have been here, and I rise quickly when I realize how many maggots are around the body. An army of them, squirming, flies everywhere. Her eye sockets are empty, staring straight up at the dark trees, as if she might be searching for the sky.
"Sam?"
Connor sounds even shakier.
"Sam!"
I move back to him. He's clicked his flashlight off, and he's breathing too fast. I turn him toward me. "Connor, I need you to listen to me. Deep breaths, okay?
this is a good thing. It's good we came here and found her. Now we need to go back and call the police. Did somebody kill her?
He's shaking. I put my hand on his forehead. He feels clammy and cold. I pull out one of the metallic insulated blankets and drape it around him.
Did somebody leave her there? The way my dad...
It might not be that at all, I lie to him, because I think he needs that comfort. She could be a hiker who got lost, had a heart attack, something like that. But it's good that she's not out here all alone anymore, right? That steadies him a little. He nods and pulls the blanket closer.
Okay, let's follow our trail back out, I tell him.
I pull out my phone and check for a signal. There is one, but it's low and slow. I dial 911 anyway as we start walking. Connor stares at his map like it's a GPS. He's not really thinking right now. I use my built-in UV light on the other end of the flashlight to check the trail markers I left. It's clear enough where we need to go.
Wolf Hunter Police Department, what is your emergency?
A voice asks me. It's tinny and ghostly, a fragile connection.
I need to report a dead body, I tell her. On the south bank of Wolf Hunter River, about 2 miles from Wolf Hunter River Lodge.
I didn't get all that, sir. Can you please repeat?
The call drops. Shit. I try again, get the same voice.
I'm calling to report a dead body, south bank of Wolf Hunter River, about 2 miles from...
Sir, I need your name, please.
Sam Cade, about 2 miles from Wolf Hunter River Lodge.
Was this person breathing, sir?
I think about the bloating, the blackened skin.
No.
Did you try CPR?
No, she's decomposed. I know they have to ask these questions, but it's infuriating. Like Connor, I'm still dealing with the sight, but unlike the kid, I've seen worse, and in person. Heading back to the lodge, send the police. I'll walk them out to the body. We left trail markers.
I hang up before the call drops again, and am slipping the phone back in my pocket when I hear a branch snap, then rustling. Something's out there. Maybe there is a bear after all. I silently bring Connor to a halt. His metallic blanket rustles, but there's nothing I can do about that. I slowly lower my pack to the ground and get out my pistol. Flashlight gets stowed. I crouch down, and Connor mimics me. I put my finger to my lips. The kid's face is pallid, and he's shaking even more, but he nods. I'm first aware of the shot, because the tree next to me explodes splinters in all directions, and one of them digs into my arm. I process that, the flat slap of the shot an instant later, and the realization that we're in desperate trouble at the same time. I grab Connor's arm and drag him right, get him safe behind a big gnarled oak and tell him, "Stay here, stay down, understand?"
"Was that a shot?"
He's shaking. A little distant. "Stay," I order him. I need to lead them away from this kid. He can't make it right now. He's in shock.
"Connor, understand?"
He nods. I move to the next tree and listen for footsteps. I don't hear anything. Whoever's taken a shot at us, he's now stationary, waiting. So I give him something to shoot at. I take off the neon orange cap I'm wearing and fling it like a frisbee. It sails a good 20 feet, and then it changes course and flies off at an angle. I don't see the shot that shreds it, but I hear it an instant later. He's a pretty good marksman, but he's slow. Maybe the first shot he took was a little too quick, a little too adrenaline-filled, because he rushed it and missed my head by a couple of inches. If he'd been steady, I'd have been out like a light. I look at Connor again. I hate leaving him here alone, shivering. But right now, it's the only choice. I need to draw this guy off. And I need to deal with him, because he's threatened my child. My kid. I've never felt it quite so strongly as I do right now, this need to defend Connor at all costs. But it's there, and it's dug deep into my guts. I go low, racing for the next cover, betting that he's not good at snapping off quick, accurate shots. He isn't. His shot comes late and buries itself in the tree I'm already behind. There's a thick crop of underbrush between this tree and the next, and I flatten out and do a combat crawl, resting my weight on forearms and toes as I slither along. It's quick and quiet, and I come up to a crouch as I make the turn. This is a thick stand of trees, and it appears impenetrable from that side. On this side it's clear, and I quickly make my way around in a wide arc that should bring him into view. It does. There are 2 feet in forest camouflage, no hunter's blaze colors or vests, shooter and spotter. They don't want to be noticed. It crosses my mind that they have military experience. If they do, the spotter will start scanning the perimeter now. Right on my count, the smaller one looks away from downrange and does a slow, meticulous sweep. I don't move. I'm pretty confident he'll miss me. I snap a twig, a small one, something that sounds like it might be a vole or shrew. I add a tiny rustle with the tip of my boot. The second man has to cover the sniper's ass. That's his job, too. And he comes to check. I could shoot both of them from cover, no problem, and I'm sure that's what Gwen would have done. But if I do that, I don't find out who set these assholes on us. I wait, and when the man's passing, I step right and press the barrel of my gun to his neck. He freezes up for a bare second, and it's just enough time for me to jam the back of his knees and send him sprawling. "Stay down," I tell him, and grab his rifle. Then I turn and fire at his friend, who's rolling to get a bead on me. I fire 3 shots, marching toward him in a neat straight row. Clear warning. He's a big bearded man, and I'm hoping that if he's a pro, if he understands his situation, he'll drop the gun and give up. He doesn't. He raises it toward me and fires. It's a wild shot, off target, but he's made that choice, and eliminated mine, too. I shoot him in the head, and I don't even blink. His death is just about instantaneous. I see his eyes flicker, then roll back, and his body goes limp. One spasm, and nothing. I turn back to his friend, who stayed sensibly still, and I press the barrel to the back of his head. Hair sizzles. "Do not move, understand?"
Yeah, sure,"
he says. He's flat on his stomach, hands now outstretched. I search him from the back, roll him over, and put the still-hot muzzle against his forehead while I check for another weapon. He winces. When I finish and back off, he has a small, perfect red circle burned into his suntanned skin.
"You a Marine or something?"
he asks me. Local accent. "Air Force," I tell him.
"Damn, didn't know they taught that shit in flight school."
"Army?" I guess. He nods. "Sorry, brother. Who sent you?"
"Who says anybody did?"
I shrug. "Not open season on kids, as far as I'm aware."
"Man, we mistook you for a doe, that's all."
"Bullshit. Somebody sent you."
"You shoot Travis?"
"If that's your buddy, yeah. Didn't have a choice," I tell him. "He's dead."
"Then fuck you, man. I ain't telling you shit."
He's a lean, tough guy in his mid-30s, a war vet, but his eyes fill with tears, and I see genuine rage behind him.
"You just killed my cousin."
I point the gun again. "Who hired you?"
"Fuck you."
He's hardened. I can see that. Grief does that to some people. I was hoping it might break him open, but instead, concrete. Maybe the cops will get something out of him. I won't. I hear a little metallic rustle and turn my head in that direction. Connor's discarded his blanket, and he's coming around the trees. I hold up a hand to stop him there. I take out my phone and dial 911 again. I tell them there's been a fatal shooting, and I have one man held at gunpoint. That'll get them moving, I hope.
"Won't do you no good,"
the prisoner tells me. The 911 operator's telling me not to hang up, so I don't. I put the phone down on the ground next to me.
"Why not?"
I ask him. "You got friends in high places, man?" He doesn't stop glaring. He really wants to kill me. I can feel it coming off him like steam.
"Not me,"
he says, and suddenly bares his teeth in what is only technically a grin.
"Travis was a cop, and you just fucking murdered him in cold blood. I seen it, you piece of shit murderer!"
He's raised his voice.
"He didn't murder anybody," Connor says, "and you tried to kill us." "You're crazy, kid. Why the hell would 2 men out hunting try to kill you? This asshole just straight up went crazy."
I realize what's happening. He wants it on the damn 911 recording. I reach down and hang up the call. Too late. We are kind of screwed. Sure, I can point to the shots Travis fired, including my shredded hunter's orange cap,
But there's always benefit of the doubt in these things, and it weighs heavily in favor of locals and cops. Travis is both. I point the gun at my prisoner again. What's your name?
Fuck off.
Okay, fuck off. Here's how this is going to go. You're going to tell the truth, because if you don't, I'm going to bring down all the hellfire in the world on you. State police, FBI, whatever I have to do to prove you're a damn liar who was hired to put a bullet in my head, which will get you 20 to life if you don't get smart fast. Who paid you? He shuts his mouth, lowers his chin, and gives me a hard stare that tells me he's never going to cooperate, not with me, and probably not for any price. Paid well enough to keep his lips zipped about it, or else he's scared that he's next on the list. Either could be true. Connor says,
Can we go back to the lodge now?
He sounds exhausted, and far too shaky. I'm sorry, but no, we need to wait here, I tell him. Wrap up, stay warm, okay? Sit down and eat something. He nods. In a few minutes, he looks better after consuming a trail bar and washing it down with water from the canteen. He's wrapped himself in the blanket like a shiny foil burrito. Jesus, it hits me all over again. He's a kid. And in one afternoon, he's seen a gruesomely dead body, been shot at, and been at the scene of a killing. Even if he didn't see me shoot Travis, and I hope he didn't, he knows it happened. I was supposed to protect him. This was supposed to be a walk in the woods. I can imagine what Gwen's going to say, which reminds me that I'd better call her. Now. But when I call her number, I get nothing but rings and voicemail. I don't leave a message. I don't have any idea how to tell her about this yet. She'll call when she sees I've tried to get her. I hope she's safe. It hits me with sick, brutal force that if someone tried to take me and Connor out, Gwen and Lanny are also at risk. I should have come to that conclusion earlier, but like Connor, my brain's not working at peak efficiency right now. I just killed the man. The calm and focus I feel in combat is starting to wear off now, and the consequences are mounting. Call me back, Gwen. But she doesn't. I want to tell her I did my best. I want to tell her I love her. But I don't get a chance. When the cops arrive, I put the gun on the ground, kneel, lace my hands behind my head, and get body slammed to the ground anyway. Knee grinding my spine, voices shouting over each other. The guy on the ground is yelling too, that I'm a stone-cold murderer, that I killed his cousin. I can't see Connor. I'm praying they don't treat him roughly, but there's nothing I can do now. Nothing. I hear Connor yelling,
Let him go!
In a voice so raw, it makes me hurt. I turn my head in that direction.
Hey!
I call to him.
Connor, stop! Relax, it's okay. Everything's okay.
You killed a cop, you prick,
the cop says.
Trust me, that ain't okay. You're getting a needle. Shut the fuck up.
Something hits me in the back of the head, and the world goes soft and loose around me. I try, but things slip away. My last thought is for Connor's safety before I plunge off the cliff into the dark.
Chapter 12. Gwen. When I arrive at the lodge, it's chaos. The parking lot, a staging area of four police cars, two ambulances, and one unmarked vehicle. My heart is hammering. My mouth is dry. Lanny's asking me questions I can't answer, and I park and bail out fast. My daughter catches up during my run toward the lodge. Mom! Mom, what's happening? I don't know, and it terrifies me. My path is blocked by a uniformed policeman, a big one, scowling at me from under the jutting bill of his hat. You can't go in there, he tells me. Lodge is closed. Where is my son? I know I should be calmer, more logical. I can't be. Connor Proctor, where is he? Back up, he orders me. I don't. When he comes toward me, we bump chests. He pauses because he can tell he's going to have to make me back off, and he's struggling to do the math of how badly that will go. Mom! Lanny grabs my arm. Where's Connor? Is he arrested too? What's going on? I'm trying to find out, honey, I tell her. And for some reason, that makes the cop take a step back. Maybe the fact that I have an anxious, frightened daughter hits home with him. I turn my attention back to him and try to start over. I'm Gwen Proctor. I know who you are, he says, hard eyes like pebbles in water. Step back. My son is back there. He's a child. And he'll be brought out. He breaks off because right at that moment, a group emerges from the trees. Paramedics, rolling a gurney with someone on it. I see the bright flash of blood and my heart just stops. I sway. Lanny grabs me tighter than ever, and I make myself, somehow, stay upright. It's not Connor. But it is Sam. He's unconscious. There's blood on the sheet under him, and I don't see a wound. God, did they shoot him in the back? The cop holds me back again, but as soon as the gurney's past me, I rush to it. There's a cordon of cops, but I break through for a second and see that he's breathing. And he's handcuffed to the railings. A cop pushes me back. I ignite. Take your damn hands off me, I shout. Did you shoot him? Ma'am, calm down. He was injured a little bit in the struggle, the cop says. And when I focus on him, I realize that he's just a kid, really. Barely old enough to buy a legal drink. He seems earnest and out of his depth, so I dial it back. Slightly. He's going to be okay. Don't promise, I say. Where's my son, Connor Proctor? Mom? Connor's voice from behind me. I see him coming with a single police escort. He's wrapped in a metallic blanket, far too pale, and I rush to him and take him in my arms. He's not in handcuffs, at least, which is good, because if he were, I might have to take on the entire police force. He looks like he's in shock. Sweetie? I kiss his cheek and push him back to look him over. No sign of injury. Did they hurt you? He shakes his head. No, I'm okay. His voice sounds lower than it usually is, and deeper. They hurt Sam, though. I saw it. The cop next to him frowns, and I quickly say, We'll talk about that later, okay? I draw Connor back into the protective hug and meet the officer's eyes directly. I want to take him to the room, now. Ma'am, he needs to come to the station and give a statement. Look at him. He's not in any shape to... No. Connor steps back. He takes the blanket off. It seems to me that my son grows inches in that moment, that he ages years, and it breaks off pieces of my heart. Mom, I need to go. Sam needs me to tell the truth. I'm okay. He isn't, but I know I can't protect him completely from this. I focus back on the cop. He's a minor, I say. I'm going with him. My daughter comes too. She's not staying here by herself. He can't really argue with me about any of that, but he seems to be searching for a way. I don't give him time. I'll drive him to the station. Ma'am, he's going to have to come with me. He isn't yielding on that point, I can tell. Because that's something he can enforce, petty as it is. He's a critical witness to the murder of a police officer. Fine, I snap. Then you take all of us. He can't find a good reason to refuse, so we crowd into the back seat of the cruiser. There's steel mesh between us and the policeman's front seat, and, I know from experience, back doors that won't open from the inside. We're in a cage now, right where they want us. But there's nothing else to be done, except start making moves of my own. As we're driven back to Wolf Hunter, as night starts to close in on this depressing, devastating town, I start texting my contacts, every one of them. I sit in the interview room while Connor gives his statement, and I am speechless to hear the scope of it, the discovery of the body. The ambush on the way back to the lodge, Sam's actions. Connor doesn't lie, as far as I can tell. He's straightforward and open, even when he tells the detective, a local one I don't know, that he didn't see the actual shooting that Sam's been accused of. He only looked around the tree when he heard the shot. That doesn't help Sam much, but I'm glad he doesn't make up a story. It would be too easy for them to trip up a kid his age. Brave as he's been, Connor still drops his chin when the detective leaves the room, though, and I realize he's crying. Finally, I think. I grab tissues and pass them over and just let him work it out. I'm glad my son can cry. When he's finished, I say, "Don't feel guilty, baby. Sam doesn't want you to lie. You told the truth. That's what matters." "I know," he says. "But, Mom, the way they treated him." He still remembers how I was treated when I was arrested. It was probably gentler than how these local cops handled things, but it was traumatic enough to leave lasting marks on my children. "He's going to be okay," I tell him. I asked Hector Sparks to show up at the hospital and protect him in case the cops want to get a statement too soon. Mike Lustig is on his way to Wolf Hunter as soon as he gets free. Kezia and Javier know what's going on. "Things will be fine, I promise." "Don't promise," he says, and gives me a sad little smile. "Sam doesn't." I wonder what that's about, but I don't let it take root. I can't right now. "I'm sorry you had to go through all this," I tell him. "I know it feels bad. I know it reminds you of things that are hard to deal with." "It's okay," he says, though it's obviously not. "I'm glad we found her. It wasn't right for her to be just left there, like nobody cared at all." "She's found now," I tell him gently. "You and Sam did that for her. She's probably one of them, those missing women." "She could be," I say, "but we don't know that." He just shakes his head. "I think she is." I don't try to talk him out of it. I ask if he wants something to drink, and when he nods, I knock on the closed door and ask for a bottle of water. The bottle comes back in the hand of the same detective from before. He brings a printed-out statement with him, and he puts the bottle, the statement, and a pen in front of my son. Connor automatically picks up the pen. I grab the paper. "What's this?" "We transcribed his statement, ma'am. It just needs his signature," the detective says. I start reading. I don't get two sentences in before I take the pen from Connor's fingers and start marking up the paper. This transcription is more like a free paraphrasing. I shove it back at the detective. He's not happy. "Ma'am, we took this directly from the recording." "I'll bet," I say, and take my phone out. "Here, let's play that game, shall we? Because I had my recorder running, too." He clears his throat, stares at me for a few seconds, and then stands up and leaves the room without a word. Connor gives me a look. "Wow, seriously? You recorded that?" I don't confirm or deny, just in case. I only smile. When the statement comes back this time, it compares to what I remember from Connor's account. I ask him to read it and correct anything that's wrong. He does on one sentence and then signs it. Before he passes it back, I take a quick picture of it. That gets an even less happy response from the detective. I'm fairly sure they were going to try something else shady, but now that I have the picture, they can't, especially if I have the recording, which I don't, but they can't be sure. We exchange stares. He leaves. Connor cracks open the bottle and drinks thirstily, like he's been without for a day. I want to tell him to slow down, but I don't. When the bottle's drained, I take it. I don't throw it away. The last thing I want is for them to fake some DNA thing to implicate my son down the line, and from what I've seen so far, I'm convinced that the police chief is probably behind this ugly push. It's not really about my son. It's about showing me who's boss. I realize that I'm indulging my natural paranoia again. They could get touch DNA from the pen he used, or the paper he's just signed. But I have to try to keep him safe. The fact that even now we're locked inside this room makes me feral. My cell phone rings. I check the number. It's from Hector Sparks. "Ms. Proctor? Yes, I wanted to let you know that I'm here at the hospital. Mr. Cade is awake. They've just taken him for an x-ray of his skull, but he says he feels all right. He has 5 stitches in his scalp. Knowing Chief Weldon, I'm sure he has some story about Mr. Cade violently resisting arrest. There's really no point in trying to challenge that, not in this town when the only witnesses are fellow police." I breathe a little easier, not that it doesn't make me angry all over again. and then I freeze. Wait, the chief of police is named Weldon? Yes, Spark says. Why? Weldon was one of the voices back at the garage, along with the owner, Carr. I don't like where this is going. Not at all. You'll stay until I can get there? I can stay for another. I can almost hear the watch check. 2 hours. However, according to Officer Helmer, as soon as the hospital clears him, he'll be taken straight to the police department. I assume you're there already? Yes. Excellent. Then as soon as he's released, I'll be on my way. I wouldn't want Mrs. Paul to have to wait dinner. Heaven forbid, I want to snap, but I somehow manage not to. Sparks's legal help is probably superfluous right now, but I can't afford to alienate the only lawyer I know. I knock on the door again. The same cop opens it. My son's just turned 12. He's had a traumatic day. He's given his statement. Either give him some food or let us go. Wait inside, he orders me, and shuts the door in my face. I do, pacing. I'm like a lion in the cage, while Connor is calm and quiet. I want to force their hand before Sam gets here. I get my wish, because the cop opens the door in 5 minutes and says, "You can go, but orders of the chief, don't leave town." That's bullshit, and I know it. Connor's not a suspect, he's a witness, and they can't pull that on a minor child. I don't push my luck, though. I get Connor out the door, into the hall, and out into the reception area. Lanny's slumped in a seat, headphones on, but she jumps to her feet the second she sees us. She runs to Connor and wraps him in a bear hug. "Don't scare me like that," she whispers to him, and he hugs her back. I feel a burn in the back of my throat that might be tears if I let myself go there. They'd be good tears for a change. Lanny rushes to give me a hug, too. "Are we leaving? Can we go see Sam? Is he at the hospital?" "We should wait here," I tell her. "Sam's going to be brought in as soon as they're done with him. I'm hoping that they'll be in a hot rush to charge him."
"You hope what? Why?"
Connor looks mystified. I give him a smile. "Because the sooner they charge him, the faster his bail can go through," I say, "and the sooner we can get the hell out of this town."
"But what if he doesn't get bail?"
Lanny asks anxiously.
"What if..."
"One crisis at a time," I tell her. Sam is brought in, and we're not allowed to get near him, but he's walking. And our eyes meet and lock for a priceless few seconds, and he mouths, "It's okay." At the same time I say, "I'll be here." And he's taken straight back to the cells for questioning. We wait until I overhear at 10 p.m. that they've arrested Sam for manslaughter. The arraignment comes at midnight. Lanny's proven correct. There is no bail, and no chance to talk to him. I shouldn't be shocked, but I am, and horrified. I don't want Sam in jail tonight, in this town. I should have realized they'd get the judge on side for this and planned accordingly. But I'm tired and scared, and I'm feeling very, very exposed. The saving grace is that Mike Lustig arrives at the courthouse just as Sam's taken away. Mike's a good man, and a black man with an FBI badge, which will be, I'm pretty sure, Chief Weldon's worst nightmare. We spend 10 minutes huddling, and I give him every piece of solid information I have, including the conversation I overheard in which Chief Weldon played a role. I tell him my speculation, too, that Marlene Crockett knew about a wreck that was quickly made to vanish by the police, Mr. Carr, the garage owner, and some third party named Carl that I can't identify yet. There's payoffs in the making, big enough to kill for.
I wonder if it's...
He starts that thought, but he doesn't finish it.
Never mind that right now. Let's just get through the night. Listen, I want you to get those kids out of this town. Take them home.
But Sam...
Leave Sam to me. I'll make myself real useful around here for the night. He won't be alone. Promise you that.
He pauses for a second.
Don't stay around here tonight. I know you're tempted, and I understand that. but I need you and them out of danger. He's right. The motel wasn't safe. The lodge wasn't either. We need to get back home, where we have friends and allies who can watch our backs. Hard as it is to go and leave Sam behind. Can I write a note? I ask Mike at the end. Will you give it to him?
Voicemail's faster, he says, and hands me his phone. Use the recorder. I'll make sure he hears it. That way they can't accuse me of trying to pass him a shiv or some bullshit like that.
Mike's read on this place is just as dire as mine, I realize. That's ominous. If you need help, call this guy, I tell him, and send him Fairweather's number from my phone. I feel his phone vibrate as it arrives. He's with the TBI. I don't think he likes the way things smell around here either. He got reassigned yesterday. I wonder how that happened.
It's a damn mystery, Mike says, and gives me a grim smile. Go on and whisper sweet nothings to your man. I won't listen.
Liar, I say, but I don't mean it. He walks a couple of feet away, and I press the record button. Then I'm temporarily voiceless. What can I say? What makes up for the fact that I'm about to drive away and leave him here in Wolf Hunter, when he came up here determined to watch my back? Sam, I say, and my voice sounds strange and emotional, and that's not what I want. I take a breath. Sorry. I need to get the kids out of here, into a safer place. So I'm going to go home until tomorrow, but I'll be back as fast as I can. I'm hoping that Javier or Kez can step in for them temporarily until we can both get the hell out of this town and decide what we do next. Mike's here for you, meanwhile. And I'm coming back for you. I promise. I hesitate, close my eyes, and say it. I love you, Sam Cade. I'm sorry. I love you. Don't forget. I end the recording and take the phone back to Mike, who gives me a long, considering look.
You going to break my friend's heart? He asks.
Depends, I say. Is he going to break mine? He doesn't answer that.
You get those kids safe. Sam will never forgive me if they get hurt on my watch.
I watch him walk away, and then we go to the waiting police vehicle that gives us a ride back to the lodge where we left the SUV. I don't like going back in for our stuff, but Lanny's adamant that she's not leaving her laptop. I make damn sure the clerk knows I'm armed and ready for trouble, and we gather everything in less than 10 minutes. Then we're on the road. Heading home. We're going to sleep in our own beds, and whatever tomorrow brings, at least we'll have that much comfort. I'm just turning onto the main road when my cell rings. The kids grumble and fall back asleep almost instantly once I answer it. Yes? My tone is guarded. It's late. I'm exhausted, and I'm in the woods on a dark, twisting road. It's black as a hole out here, except for the wash of my headlights across the asphalt. The jump of the yellow center line, the green from the trees flashing past.
Ms. Proctor?
I recognize that careful Virginia voice. Detective Fairweather. Pretty late to be calling. It's almost 1 a.m. I know because I've checked, and I can count the time by the ache in my bones at this point.
It is, he says.
He sounds as tired as I feel.
I just got back from a fingertip search of a field about 50 miles from Wolf Hunter. We had a tip Ellie White might be there. All I got to show for it are dirty hands and a sore back.
But you're calling me?
Because I heard about Mr. Cade's situation, he says.
He sounds grim.
Did you bail him out?
I couldn't. No bail.
County lockup?
No, I say. He's in Wolf Hunter.
Well, hell.
It's mildly shocking to hear even that much of a curse from him.
I can cook up something in the morning, but I'm worried he's going to have some trouble tonight in that jail.
Are you telling me they're that bad? Wolf Hunter PD?
Accidents happen, he says flatly.
It's not exactly agreement.
Most cops won't cross that blue line, and I'm not surprised. I might be able to work something in the morning, but... But you're worried he might, what, hang himself from a bedsheet in the middle of the night? Something like that. Are the kids all right? I heard one of them was with him during the shooting. Connor, I say, and glance over at the rearview mirror. My son is leaning against the side window, fast asleep. He's okay. We're heading out for the night, back to Stillhouse Lake. I can hear an infinity of weariness in his voice as he says, "Then I guess I'd best head back to Wolf Hunter and find some excuse to visit the prisoner for a while. Let them know the TBI has an eye on this." I'm deeply grateful. And then I'm wary, too. I don't know Fairweather that well, and though he seems trustworthy enough, maybe he isn't. Or maybe Wolf Hunter has gotten under my skin and is poisoning my view of everyone I've met since coming into its dark borders. No need. Sam's friend is FBI, and he's there helping out.
Friends in high places?
I don't acknowledge that. Sam will make it through the night, and I'll be back in the morning as soon as I can. We will get him out of there. He shot a man who was trying to kill him and Connor. Self-defense, pure and simple.
It's never so simple when the victim's law enforcement. I hear he's charged with manslaughter. You might have tough sledding making a self-defense case. You going to hire Hector Sparks?
Do I have much of a choice? We flash past a mile marker that tells me we're now 5 miles outside of Wolf Hunter. I start to relax a little. Got a tense drive to make and a short sleep coming, but just being out of that town's shadow makes me feel better. Thank you for reaching out, Detective. It means a lot to know you're paying attention to what's going on in this town.
Oh, trust me, I am, he says. Okay, Miss Proctor, you drive safe, and I'll talk to you.
A rifle shot explodes through our back window and out the front. I register the icy fracture of the glass an instant before I hear the hot crack of the shot. The first impulse that shoots through me is red, urgent, and it makes me pull the wheel to the side. The car lurches sickeningly, and even as I consciously form a plan, I'm pressing the gas to the floor and straightening out to avoid running off the road. I hear Lanny screaming something, and that's when I focus on the round hole that's been punched in our front window, and the thick spiderweb of cracks still expanding out from it. The back window is worse. I gasp and check my side mirror. We're being chased. There's a truck behind us, and a guy standing in the bed of it, leaning forward and bracing himself. He's got a hunting rifle of some kind, and he's taking aim. We're going fast, but our pursuers are gaining.
Connor, I shout. Are you okay?
Yes, he says.
Lanny. Mom, they're shooting at us.
Both of you, get down and hold on. It takes a precious couple of seconds for them to be concealed, protected, and I compensate by swerving over the line and back to spoil the bastard's aim. Once I'm sure my kids are okay, I take another deep breath, send off a microsecond of prayer, and hit the brakes as hard as I can. My SUV screeches, fights, tries to slide. I leave a long trail of thick rubber on the road. The pickup behind me is forced to brake hard because they'd been accelerating to get closer, and the rifleman gets thrown against the cab so violently that he loses his rifle. It clatters to the road and bounces off into a ditch. Before they're fully stopped, I'm flooring the SUV again and reaching for my phone. I intend to dial 911, but I realize that I've forgotten all about Detective Fairweather. He's shouting in my ear.
Gwen! Gwen! What the hell is...
Call 911, I tell him. We're just past 5 miles out on the main road. We're being followed by a pickup, and a man with a rifle is in the bed shooting. Another shot shatters more glass. He has a backup gun. I can barely see the road ahead, but I can crouch and look through a clear patch. Keep us on the road. I don't dare slow down. Fairweather's saying something, but I can't understand him. My attention is fixed on the problem behind me. I finally realize he's saying, license number, description. Yelling it, actually.
I can't see him, I tell him. There's no light out here.
Pickup, definitely. One shooter in the bed of the truck. Jesus, my kids are here. I can hear him repeating what I've said. He must have two phones going. Okay, dispatch is sending a county sheriff cruiser your way. He'll be coming from the opposite direction. They want you to pull over when you see it coming at you. Do you understand? I'm not stopping until the pickup does, I tell him. Ben, my kids. I take a deep breath. The driver's a white male, clean-shaven, looks thin, maybe 30. More shots ring out. I look back and see the shooter is up again, a bearded asshole in an old camo jacket and trucker hat. He doesn't have his rifle anymore, but he's got a semi-automatic handgun, and he's pumping off shots as fast as he can. There's a curve, and I have to slow down or risk a wreck, and multiple shots land in the metal of the car. I hear it and feel the impact, but at least he's not as good a shot with the handgun as he was with a rifle. I accelerate again once we're grooved into the curve. My SUV has better running power. I can't see any cars coming. We're completely alone. How long until the damn cruiser gets here? I shout at Fairweather. 5 minutes, he says. Hold on, Gwen. They're coming. In 5 minutes, we're going to be dead if the shooter manages to hit a tire, which is what he's trying to do. Kids, are you okay? My voice is shaking. I'm not sure if that's from rage or terror or both. There's a second of silence, and I feel a sick drop of horror. But then Connor says, from somewhere near the floorboard in the back, I'm okay, Mom. I'm okay, Lanny says. She's in the footwell of the passenger side, curled up in a protective ball. But she looks up at me with a clear question on her face. Why is this happening to us? I honestly don't know, and I try to swallow my fear, but my mouth is as dry as Death Valley. I try to focus completely on the road ahead, the truck behind. My kids are all right. We're going to be all right. We have to be all right. I see the curve coming. It's not as sharp as the others. It's perfect. Hold on, I tell Fairweather, who's trying to talk to me. I have to try something. I drop the phone on the seat next to me. Then I swerve wide, and the truck follows me over the double yellow line. The firing had paused for reloading, but now it resumes, a staccato pop, 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 as fast as the man can pull the trigger. I ease off the gas and let the truck roar up fast. Then I floor it and veer off sharply around the curve. They don't see it coming. The driver is fixated on me, and he's accelerating too hard to easily change course, and as I pull away to the side, he finds he's headed straight for the ditch. When he tries to correct, his back tires lose traction. I see the whole vehicle shimmy violently, and then the spin begins as the lighter truck bed torques and flings the cab sideways. The man in the back is thrown clear, and I see him flying through the air in the sweep of the truck's headlights as he spins before I hear a short, panicked cry. He vanishes from view. I hear him land. It sounds unforgiving. I keep driving, gaze riveted on the rearview mirror and the truck that has ended up stopping in the wrong lane, facing the wrong way. After a long second or two, the truck suddenly accelerates, straightens into the correct lane, and screeches off in the opposite direction, back toward Wolf Hunter. They don't stop for their friend. I look ahead, but I still don't see flashing lights or hear the reassuring sound of sirens. The truck could turn around. They could come back. I don't think they will, though. They've lost a rifle, a handgun, and at least one of their buddies on this road. And they can't know if they've wounded one of us, but they do know we can keep on running. I ease off the gas, alert for any sign of headlights coming for us from behind. Nothing. The darkness here is breathless, oppressive, and I know I should keep moving. The asshole who was shooting at me is back there. He might even still have his gun. But he also might be bleeding out on the road, praying for help. I'm a paranoid asshole when it comes to the survival of my family, but I'm also human. I don't want to leave someone to die alone, not even someone who tried to kill us, especially not if he can answer questions about why. Mom? I look down at my daughter. Are they gone? She sounds tough and calm. I see tear tracks on her face gleaming in the dashboard light. Yeah, baby. They ran away. It's okay. Connor, sweetie, are you all right? He's already scrambling up in the back seat and staring out the cracked back window. I'm looking at the side mirror. I see no movement at all. Yeah, he says. Nothing else. I think it's so I don't hear how frightened he really is. My son's already been shot at once today. My temporary wave of empathy recedes, and I want to kill these assholes, including the one lying in the road. Both of you strap in. I check the speed. We're still doing half again the posted rate, but I don't give a shit. I want the police. And finally, I see the red and blue flashers bleeding through gaps in the trees. The road must curve again up ahead. I finally remember Fairweather was on the phone, but when I look for the device, it's gone. Thrown into the well between the passenger door and seat, most likely, but definitely out of reach. I slow down and pull over. I have to wait for a few seconds after I switch off the engine to try to get control of myself. My hands are shaking so badly, I almost drop the keys when I hand them to Lanny. Find my phone. It should be somewhere over on your side. Detective Fairweather's on the line, hopefully. If not, call him back. Tell him what happened and is happening. Lock these doors and stay alert. If I get arrested or something happens to me, you get Connor out of here immediately. Just drive. Understand? Call Javier and Kez for help and get somewhere safe. Do not stop unless you think you're safe. I don't care what else happens. She nods. I'm asking a lot of her, but I know Lanny. I know she can do it and will. Mom, she says as I start to close the door. Our eyes meet and hold. I love you. I love you too. Both of you. So much. Connor, please listen to your sister until I get back. I will, he says, which is rare. I love you too, Mom. I shut the door. I feel the locks engage as I lean against the SUV and hold up both hands. The county sheriff's cruiser comes hard around the corner and immediately slows, pulls over, and brakes. There's a short delay, reporting their position and my license plate, I assume. And then the lone deputy gets out and slowly comes toward me, taking in the SUV, the two kids in the car, and that my hands are up. He has his hand on his gun. What's your name, ma'am? He asks. Not, are you the one who called for assistance? That's actually smart. Gwen Proctor, I say, and I see him physically relax, but he still asks to see ID. I provide it. He's a pot-bellied man of middle age, African-American, with a shaved head and close-trimmed beard. I don't know what happened, but we were chased and shot at with a rifle, and then with a handgun. Is anyone injured? No, we're all right. Can you ask the children to exit the vehicle, please? I don't want the kids out of the car. Not yet. I'd rather leave them inside until you've secured the area. He frowns. Ma'am. The man shooting was thrown from the bed of the truck toward the end of the chase, but I don't know if he's still capable of firing. Until I know he's disarmed, they need to stay safe. He accepts that and says, Where was he thrown? Back there at the curve, I point. I'll go with you. It looked like he was tossed to the northbound side. No, ma'am. I want you to stay here with your vehicle and do not move. I'll be back as soon as I can. There should be a second response vehicle coming in another couple of minutes. You wait for him. With that, he's off into the dark, only the jerky motion of his flashlight beam marking his position. I knock on the window. Lanny, now in the driver's seat, rolls it down. Phone, I tell her. She hands it over. Thanks, sweetie. Close this now. I check for a signal and find two bars. Thank God. And even better, Fairweather's somehow still on the line. Gwen? Christ almighty, you scared me. Yeah, sorry, I say, which is just reflex. I'm not sorry. I'm happy as hell that luck made him witness to all this. I had to make some defensive moves. The truck's gone now, headed toward Wolf Hunter. We're okay, The first cruiser is here. The deputy's looking for the shooter who was thrown clear.
You ever get a clear look at the make and model?
I did when it spun out. Red Ford F-150, I'm pretty sure. It can't be too hard to find. It looked newish.
How are the kids?
Scared to death, I say. And my kids have been through enough without this on top of things. If they want evidence, my SUV is full of bullet holes, and maybe there's an actual bullet they'll be able to salvage and match. This wasn't just some random country harassment. They wanted me dead, detective. And I want to know who and why. I think I already do know, but I'm not completely sure about Fairweather. Not enough to tip my hand to him anyway. I realize that my voice is rising and I'm shaking hard. The adrenaline is being flushed out of my system now that I know things are calming down. My head is full of horrible visions of my children, wounded, bleeding, dead. And where I was calm before, I can't control the rage that's rising. I want to kill these men for threatening my kids. Detective Fairweather is talking, and I try to catch up on what he's been saying.
License plate?
No, I tell him. Like I told you, it's dark out here on the roads, and I had headlights in my rear view most of the time.
Did the truck wreck? Any body damage?
No, spun out, got straight. It headed back toward Wolf Hunter. He covers the phone and talks to someone, probably the dispatcher again. I can hear the voices, but not the message.
Right, he says. The bolo is going out now for the truck. Anything distinctive about it that you noticed? Bumper stickers, dents, rust?
It's got some mud on it, but it's in good shape, I say. American flag sticker in the back window, I think. But I didn't have a lot of time to study it. I was trying to stay alive. The second county cruiser's flashing lights are starting to strobe the trees, so I finish with Fairweather and put the phone away. I repeat the ritual of holding up my hands as the second deputy steps out. He seems more aggressive than the first.
Keep those hands up, he shouts.
His halogen headlights are washing harshly over me, the SUV, and the road.
Higher.
If I go any higher, I'll dislocate a shoulder. But I try. I stand perfectly still, since he seems like the type who'll kill me for a twitch, and he spins me and plants me against the hood of the SUV. I'm instantly somewhere else, my palms against the searing hot metal of the old Gina Royal mommy van, my vulnerable young children staring wide-eyed through the windshield, the demolished garage wall of our old house, a dead woman swaying at the end of a wire noose inside the broken wall. It's a flashback. A bad one. The urge to slam backward against the invasive hands of this deputy is almost overwhelming. Breathe, I tell myself. This is different. This is now. You're safe. You're safe. It doesn't feel different. He finally steps back but keeps one hand against my back.
Don't move, he orders. Get those kids
out of the vehicle, he's about to say, but he doesn't get that far. The other deputy calls to him, and he emphasizes staying in place with a last shove to my spine before I hear him moving off with heavy footsteps. I turn and watch as he clicks on his flashlight and directs the beam on his African-American colleague. I realize the two of them are standing over a man who's lying crumpled off to the side of the road, his top half dangling down into a ditch. He must be dead, or deeply unconscious, because he's not moving at all. Even to recover from an unnatural position. The two men silently look down on the body. Finally, one deputy crouches down and leans into the ditch, with the other holding his belt for stability, and I presume he checks for signs of life. It's obviously futile from the shake of his head when he's pulled upright again. Then both men are headed back toward me. This time, I don't raise my hands. I cross my arms.
Check your car for front-end damage.
The white deputy orders, and I see the black one give him a long side eye, but he decides this isn't worth it and goes to look.
Nothing, he says. No sign of any damage here.
They're looking for evidence that I ran the guy down, I realize. He was thrown from the bed of the truck when it spun out. I didn't hit him or the truck, I say. I guess you can call it an accident in commission of attempted murder. The deputy sent to check for front damage proceeds around the car toward the back and says,
Jesus, come look at this. Must be 5 shots that hit here, not counting the window damage.
The white deputy joins him, and I see the flashlight playing over the cracked and broken glass.
Huh, he says. Don't know that those weren't there already.
I hear the resentful mistrust. That's when it becomes clear to me that this man knows exactly who I am. Unlike the first deputy, he didn't ask for my ID, didn't ask what happened. He's already made up his mind that I'm somehow to blame just for existing. And I feel a sick, metallic taste forming in the back of my throat. Gwen Proctor. Gina Royal. Whoever I might be, there will always be someone who thinks the worst of me and tries in petty ways to make my life more difficult.
Look, there's shell casings all over the road back there,
the black deputy says, and I can tell he's growing impatient now.
She was on the phone with Detective Fairweather the whole time. I could hear the shots when I was hooked up on the call, couldn't you? We can have this discussion later. I'm calling out the detectives. Let them sort this mess out.
On the one hand, that's good news. I'd been afraid he'd send the first deputy on his way, and then claim I'd gone for his gun and shoot me dead somewhere out of sight of the kids. Paranoid? Sure. But then, someone's clearly out to get me. On the other hand, having detectives in the mix can mean anything. They won't necessarily be on my side, either. I can only hope that Fairweather will show up for me. Fairweather does, in fact, show up. The detective takes me and the kids to the county sheriff's station, which is about 30 minutes away. My SUV's towed in for evidence processing. I know I'm in for long, dark hours of saying the same things over and over again, and so are my kids. I don't tell them what to say. They know to tell the truth. I look up at the black sky on the way inside. Sam, I think. Please be okay. I'm not wrong about the long hours or the exhaustion that takes hold. After my statement, I catch a catnap with my head down on my crossed arms on the table, and when I wake up, I find that the kids are camping out on a fold-out couch, sound asleep.
They're okay, Fairweather tells me. A couple of minor scratches from the broken glass.
You? Sore, I tell him. But that's from stress and lack of sleep. I'm sure you feel that way, too. He silently offers me a bottle of ibuprofen, and I take 2 with a swig of not-great coffee.
How's Sam? He asks me.
And for a second, I wonder when exactly our guarded relationship progressed to first names. It was Ms. Proctor and Mr. Cade with him, but now it's Gwen and Sam. I suppose around the time he had to listen to me being shot at, which was a vivid demonstration of just how far people will go to actually get me. I've been moved to a category of persons he actually cares about. Mike texted me, I tell him. Peaceful night, seems like.
Mike's the FBI agent you talked about?
Yeah, Mike Lustig.
He's the one broke the Absalom case,
Fairweather says. I raise my eyebrows.
I follow the news time to time. He got some kind of commendation, too.
That's him, I say. Big man on federal campus right now, at least. That must have registered with Chief Weldon.
Yeah, about Weldon,
Fairweather stirs his coffee.
He was a pretty straight shooter when he started 5 years back in the office, but lately he's been...
shady, I say.
Let's just say that there are some people in town who can do no wrong, as far as the locals are concerned.
But not V. Crockett.
No, nor Marlene.
I take a risk. She worked at the garage, right? For Mr. Carr?
You know anything about him? Carr's a weird old duck. He's got a place out of town, a compound.
Compound is a telling choice of words. I'm guessing visitors aren't welcome?
He's got a wall, Fairweather agrees. It's topped by cameras and floodlights. I don't think he likes visitors much.
I've never had any cause to go inside. But I get the idea that he'd like to nose around in there. And he's friends with Chief Weldon. Cousins. They have any other relatives around here? It's a small town, Miss Proctor, and cousins abound. Any of them accountants? Bankers, maybe? He stares at me for a few seconds before he says, Carl Weldon works at the bank. His father is Chief Weldon's daddy's brother. Why do you ask? I don't think I want to tell him any more details. If I do, and I'm wrong, my kids are in even more danger. He has enough to be on his guard about if he's not in on all this. I just shake my head and leave it there. How long before they let us leave? I glance at the clock hanging over the coffee machine. It's now 3:30 in the morning. Despite the coffee, I feel like I'm running on empty, and my stomach rumbles to remind me that it's been many hours since I last ate. I made sure the kids had something, but I've skipped a couple of meals now, and I'm suffering for it. Well, you can go any time you want, but your SUV's going to be in evidence processing and held here. You got another way home? I don't, and I'm not even sure it's worth going home at this point. I'm not sure where to go from here, I tell him. I'll be honest, I'm so exhausted, and I'm really afraid that the place we were staying, the lodge, might have been part of this attack on Sam and Connor. Can't go back there. There's always the Motel 6. It ain't fancy, but I can guarantee you that it's not owned by one of the Weldons. I can send you back there in a cruiser and ask them to stick around, make sure you're okay. At least you can get a few hours of rest. I hate it, but he's right. I'll still need transportation for later, if I can't get my SUV back. I got a buddy with a garage out of Fountain Ridge. He can get one of his loaners out in about an hour. He'll want a good faith deposit, though,